ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Olin, and this is the My View Matters Radio Network. We are dealing with some technical difficulties tonight, but we are here with you live, as we are almost every Sunday night. And we have a handful of things to talk about, a couple of big important things, actually, tonight. We're going to talk about Cantor's defeat, and we're going to talk about the IRS losing the email. And if you'd like to call in here tonight, the number is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And, again, we are keeping with the same format as usual, where I'm going to go over stuff during the first half, and then we'll take your calls during the second half. We are going to be joined by co-host Dave later in the show, and if nothing else, we'll get his opinion of what's going on. But to get things started, as usual, we're going to start with the random political rhetoric generated for us tonight. Tonight's randomly generated political rhetoric is, my opponent is working with ExxonMobil executives, pedophiles, and overseas manufacturers. Oh, political rhetoric generator, you can be such fun. Also, I did get another one of the random correlations and thought I'd go ahead and share that with you again tonight as well. The random correlation for tonight is the direct correlation between the divorce rate in Maine and the U.S. per capita consumption of margarine. So the rate of consumption of margarine state countrywide matches the divorce rate in Maine for the years 2000 through 2009. And again, remember, that's all about emphasizing the difference between correlation and causation. Certainly the divorce rate in Maine does not cause people to consume margarine, nor does the consumption of margarine affect the rate of divorce in Maine. But they correlate. All right, let's talk about the Eric Cantor defeat first, because this is a really interesting thing for me. So in politics, there are a handful of rules. And one of the rules that I've always thrown out there, and is generally a good rule of thumb, is that if you're getting outspent more than 5-1, you're going to lose. You can win being outspent up to about 4-1 with a really good message. If you have a tremendous message that resonates, and especially if your opponent does not, you can still win being outspent 4-1. And that is kind of a rule that I've been able to determine by observing different elections, different races, different things. You know, it doesn't matter if your message is awesome if you are getting completely blown out of the water when it comes to the media, which is where most money is spent in campaigns. It's spent on media because of the size of the elections. So it was very interesting to see the defeat of Eric Cantor in a race where he outspent his opponent 20-1. 20-1. Eric Cantor spent 20 times the money, almost 20 times, the money that his opponent did. And it's apparently the first time since 1899 that a majority House leader has been defeated in this way. And, you know, he's basically the number two guy in the U.S. House of Representatives, right behind John Boehner. And this is a big deal. It was unexpected. Eric Cantor, in fact, wasn't even in Virginia the day of the election. He was in D.C. So obviously he thought he had it in the bag. Most of the polls that were out there were showing that Cantor was polling in the low 40s and was polling in the mid 30s. And so if you figure that most of the undecideds are going to break about evenly or at some sort of ratio, he pretty much figured that he had it in the bag. And what's interesting about this David Brad guy is a college professor of economics at Randolph-Macon College. Apparently, it's a smaller private college in Virginia. I don't know a whole lot about it. Some of my friends in Virginia were telling me it's just one of those, you know, small little colleges they have scattered throughout Virginia. It's an old college. It's been around for a long time. And, you know, stark differentiation between the campaign. Cantor's campaign was holding fundraisers, big steak dinners as fundraisers. David Brad was not. A lot of interesting theorizing going on what the heck happened in this race. Because, again, getting outspent 20-1, I mean, 20-1 is huge. It's a whomping. And at 20-1, you should see that even with the best message, even with disgruntled voters, even with anything that you could throw at it, a 20-1 spending disparity in a U.S. congressional race should at the very worst case scenario for the guy with the money mean he only wins by 10 points, a 55-45 race. I mean, that's typically what you would expect to see. And so it's very, very interesting to see that this came out very differently. That the, in fact, actually, it came out the opposite, that the challenger, who was outspent 20-1, basically what that means, by the way, is he spent 5% of the money in the race, whereas the incumbent spent 95% of the money. I mean, that's another way to look at this 20-1 disparity. I mean, that's a huge spending difference, right? 5% versus 95% spending. People are just scratching their heads, and there's been a lot of theorizing as to what the heck happened. Brad was never really considered a Tea Party candidate, per se. He was just a dude. There were some conservative talk show hosts that were supporting him and encouraging people to support him, but he never got the, for instance, the millions of dollars in PAC money from different outside PACs, like we saw here in Kentucky in our most recent senatorial primary. It was not millions of dollars floating around here. If I remember the numbers correctly, I think it was 5.5 or 5.6 million that Cantor raised, and about 300,000 that David Brad raised. And that's, again, that's a huge amount of money. I mean, think about that. $5.5 million versus $300,000. That's a huge disparity. So what are some of the things that came out of this? One of the big things was it was the highest turnout in a Republican primary in 10 years. And that's kind of interesting. It goes to show that if you can get your people to the polls, you will win. Cantor, the last time he had a primary, basically, he lost a few thousand of his supporters, right? He got a lower number of votes in the primary than he did the last time he ran. But there were basically a whole lot of new people that voted this time that hadn't voted previously. About 20,000 people showed up that hadn't voted the last time. And you're talking about a race with 65, 70,000 votes. So that makes a big difference. 1,000 voters instead of 45,000 voters, that dramatically changes the race. And that's something we do know. That's something we do know happened, that the turnout was the highest in a very long time on the Republican primary side. And it tells you that, you know, if you get your supporters to turn out and you've got good support, getting them to turn out obviously makes a big deal and a big difference. Some of the folks on the left are saying that because Cantor was the only Jewish Republican, that there was some sort of anti-Semitism movement amongst the fundamental, you know, evangelicals of the Tea Party. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that that's the case. And it's really stupid to make that claim. If you know anything about evangelical Christians, they're all about, you know, protecting Israel and blah, blah, blah. So that's a ridiculous claim. Another claim that's been made in several places by several different outlets was the issue of amnesty for immigrants, undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, whatever you want to call them. But that seems to be the one issue that David Brat hit the hardest, was that Cantor seemed to be trying to play both sides of the issue and was kind of wishy-washy, flippy-floppy, not real strong on the particular issue. Whereas Brat came out strongly against amnesty. And that's where most of the pundits are putting the race right now. They're saying that that's what was triggered the anomaly. But I think in my research on this, the Christian Science Monitor probably had the best summary of this. And this race is a weird anomaly, and I agree completely. And this, and they say that this loss of for Cantor, this loss is so stunning, it will be studied for years to come in order to try to figure out what happened. And I agree. I agree with that. The broader point of this is that a lot of times people get caught up in the can't win syndrome. Well, you know, I'd vote for that guy, but he can't win. I'd vote for that person. They can't win. But this is an example of what happens when people get over their fears, that the lesser of two evils game or whatever it is that motivates people to act against their own interests and against their own beliefs in the fear of getting something even worse, dun, dun, dun. They can get over that hump in a large enough number, then the good guy can win. I don't know this David Brat. I have no idea if he's really a good guy or not. I've been told his campaign manager is a 23-year-old libertarian. That's what I've been told. I don't know anything else about this race. Obviously, no one was following this race. No one. I mean, it's a complete and total shock that this guy won. And so I still have more homework to do. And, again, I'm kind of network internet crippled at the moment, and so I can't dig in as deep as I want. And I don't even know if the polling and all that was even really done to a hardcore extent to show any sort of direction or bias or, you know, anything to that extent. I just don't know. I wasn't watching this race. There was no reason to watch it, you know, prior to the actual election happening in the prize result. But the point is that people who are good candidates, who may not be the best funded, who may not be the most connected, who may not have, you know, 157 years of political experience, do have the opportunity, do have the chance to win if enough people vote for the best candidate rather than against the worst. And I'm hoping anyway that this moment not only shakes up the political establishment, you know, for the reasons that over it's been over 100 years that the House Majority Leader has been knocked out, but more importantly, it wakes up the public so that the public knows that there's a real opportunity to make changes by not being afraid to do the right thing. That's the important thing here. In my mind, do the right thing. All right, switching gears. The IRS email scandal that broke a couple of days ago here started to do research when I became technologically handicapped. But they claim that Lois Lerner, the former head of the IRS, that her email is not able to be obtained despite a congressional mandate for it to be turned over. They're claiming that a computer crash, a single computer crash, what they're saying, has caused all of that data to be lost. Now, some of you in my audience know, and what others don't and will in a moment, my daytime job, what I do for a living, believe it or not, I don't do this for a living, nor any of the other political stuff that I do. What I do to earn a paycheck to pay for all my other hobbies is enterprise level data storage and backup. So I work for large companies, although I've done contracts for smaller companies too, but primarily large companies hire me through my company, through the company I work for, storage and backup. And I can tell you for a fact that this story does not add up. What we are being told, that a single server crash has eliminated the data and it's just gone, has significant flaws. First of all, when they say server crash, right, this infers that a machine went down, that something got corrupted, that some piece of hardware broke, that something went wrong, but it didn't physically like catch fire or the facility was destroyed or anything like that, right? This was a server crash. Just like your regular machine at home, right? If your machine at home crashes, it means that some component in the system critical to the operation of the computer has broken. And you can take that to a Best Buy and decide whether or not it's worth to, or whatever big box, or even your local computer shop, and decide whether or not it's worth investing the money to get it repaired, right? And that's cool. I mean, you know, if you want to, cool. If you don't, cool. But in this case, this is the government, right? And we have this cool thing called the Freedom of Information Act. And the Freedom of Information Act is not quite as strong as the Kentucky Open Records Act, but it is a strong law that, and actually there's a couple of other states that have even stronger laws than Kentucky does, but it requires information be retained and made available to the public unless it presents an issue of national security. Now, certainly, IRS and taxes generally do not pose a threat. The information does not pose a threat to national security. Now, there could be personal information, and those would be protected as well. At least at a minimum, any information that would make it so that the public would be able to determine that, you know, this information belongs to person XYZ, right? They would be in a position where they would need to redact any information that was personalized, much like here in Kentucky, right? If you get information on an event and it contains personal information on a person, they'll redact it, right? They use the black marker of doom and then photocopy the they make a photocopy, they use a black marker on the photocopy and then photocopy it again so that all you get, you know, you don't get people's social security numbers and other uniquely identifying information. But that information is supposed to be preserved in part exactly for the scenario where we as Americans have the right to demand information either directly or through our congressmen. And in this scenario, it's our congressmen demanding this information. This story does not make sense, though, because as a technology professional, as one who does this for a living, these guys are either running a configuration that's not even worthy of a small four-person business, and we're talking about the IRS, which is like one of the largest employers in the United States, or something is a little fishy here. So my guess, and I don't know all of the details, but the way the government works is that applications are approved for use through one branch of bureaucracy, right? One branch of bureaucracy says, these are the things that are approved for use in your branch or, you know, by the government in general, right? And they'll usually give you one or two or three things to choose from. It's not like a big, long list. This list is also usually several years old as far as the software that's approved. It's usually several versions back. It's not the latest and greatest stuff that came out, The best I've personally ever seen in dealing with state governments is that approved applications are somewhere between 6 to 12 months old by the time they're approved. And so it's important to note that, because chances are very good what they're using, what a lot of people use at work, is Microsoft Exchange. And that's what people tend to use these days. There are still a few other players out there in the world, but typically, and I've used those and I've backed those up and all that stuff too and protect their data, but typically they would be running Microsoft Exchange. So in running Microsoft Exchange, there's two versions that they're likely to have been allowed to have run. There's Exchange Server 2007, which came out in 2007, and Exchange Server 2010, which came out in 2010. There is also Exchange Server 2013, but I don't believe that they would be allowed to run 2013 yet. Despite the fact that it is 2014, a mail application is pretty complex and has big ramifications and whatnot, and so they have to test it against all the regulations and all that jazz and FOIA compliance and archiving and blah, blah, blah. There's lots of reasons why 2013 is probably not certified. So in Exchange 2007, the main mechanism of the primary level is through a cluster. It's when two machines communicate to each other. And they use what is known as a replication technology, moving the data back and forth, known as log shipping. Now, what do you mean by log shipping? Log shipping means that the database that contains all of the emails sends a copy of the transaction. So when a database writes and says, I have written this data to this database, thank you very much for the data, it then says, oh, and by the way, I need to send a copy of that data over to this other server because he's my replication partner. I need to make sure that he has the latest data too. And so the logs of what was written are sent over to the other side. Think of it maybe as a ledger for a store, right? It's one thing to have a pile of receipts, and then you've got a ledger, and the ledger is what gets kept around. You don't keep every receipt in a retail scenario. So we've shipped the data over. Now, that's protected, right? Two servers simultaneously. I cannot believe in that scenario, if they're running Exchange 2007, that the IRS would not have a cluster in place. It does not make sense for Exchange to not have a cluster in place when it's the IRS. Again, if it was a company with four people or even 10 or 20 people, okay. When you're talking about the IRS, one of the largest employers in the United States, I'm guessing they have more than one Exchange server. In fact, I know they have to, if everybody's got email, because Exchange won't scale high enough to allow that many people on one server. It would crash and burn if it tried. The other option is Exchange 2010, which basically does the same thing, but it's a little smarter about it, and without getting too technical, it basically, if you think about it as two cashiers being at the checkout line instead of one, right? Everybody doesn't have to go through one cashier. Now you can go through two cashiers, and each cashier, when the transaction's done, it sends it to the other one so that there's an exact copy of everything on both sides, what we call active-active. You've got two work engines able to work at the same time. But again, the same principle applies. The information is in two places at the same time on purpose, because if one side gets screwy and catches fire or gets corrupted or crashes or whatever, you can't just go, oh, well, email's down. Uh-huh. You can't do that. And so point is that the data should have been, when it was live data, in two places at the same time. Now, last year they were told that the information was archived. Now, I also, again, because I do backup and storage and all that, I know what that means. Archiving means that the data not only is living on those two servers, right, but it also has a third copy that is kept for permanent retention. And it's important to note that that's an important piece of being able to comply with FOIA or open records or anything like that, is the archiving of every email that comes in or out of a mail server. Because you need to be able to know what happened. You can't just say, well, the employee got in there and deleted it. Oh, sorry, I can't get it. That doesn't comply. If there's corruption going on, how would you ever know if all they have to do is delete the data to protect themselves? That would be idiotic. So in order to comply with, you know, transparency laws, you're going to have something that specifically addresses the ability to retain the data. That is what an email archiver is typically for. Now, it's funny because they've put these requirements in place for any public business to do this. This is what the public side has to do. Sarbanes-Oxley requires that publicly traded companies retain and archive all of their mail. I can't remember how long it is, 7 years or 10 years or something. I can't remember now. I don't care about that side of it because I'm an implementer, right? I implement the stuff. I don't really care about the 7 or 10 years down the road. Heck, the first ones I've implemented are just now finally starting to purge off data at 7 to 10 years. But the point is that law passed a decade ago really fueled email archiving and made the products a lot better because it became a much bigger market. Every publicly traded company had to have it. And so the idea that a single crash lost the data is just not feasible. It's not possible. You would have to be the most incompetent idiot to not be able to configure a very basic system using Microsoft's best practices, which is a document. Best practices is a term we use that it's a document that the vendor puts out that says, this is the right way to run this, right? It's kind of like, think of it as a manual for your car, right? And your manual says, hey, you should like keep gas in the car and you should change the oil and, you know, tune it up and stuff. I mean, that's, you know, it's the same kind of thing, right? It's here's how to set this up and make it run right, and here's the care and feeding of your server. There is no way, unless it is, you have two choices here. You have utter and gross incompetence to the point where it is criminally negligent incompetence. Because how in the world would they ever be able to comply with a FOIA request if they just let data just die and go away because they're idiots and set it up wrong? Oh, I should mention, too, by the way, on these servers, not only are they mirroring the data between the servers, but locally on disk, we use what's called RAID. It's a redundant array of independent drives that basically splits the data up across multiple drives and makes it so that the loss of a single hard drive doesn't matter because other drives have enough information to rebuild the RAID group, as we call it. So you can lose a hard drive, you can lose a server, you can lose both servers and have the archiver still going. How in the heck did they lose this information? It doesn't make sense. Unless they let people download and delete mail off the server, which then would not comply the rules around FOIA requests. How could, if you can just make it so that, oh, I don't want people to see my email, I'm just going to download it and delete it off the server, that can't comply with FOIA. The Freedom of Information Act, by the way, is what I keep saying, FOIA. And so it's either gross incompetence, which is what I mean, I could go that route, gross incompetence, okay, Although, typically, and I'll tell you, I've been in a lot of government shops. And honestly, despite the fact that they are government shops and move slower, at least at the city and the county and the state level, they're not idiots. They do, actually, if anything, they over-engineer the heck out of stuff. Because of the liabilities, because of open records laws, they over-engineer the heck out of these systems. I've seen them. It's what I do. So the idea that the system was in a position where it was just criminally, negligently, ignorantly set up is a possibility, but it is very unlikely. And they're trying to say, oh, well, this is back because of Lois Lerner's laptop when it crashed. Oh, yeah. Well, that shouldn't have been the only copy of the data. Again, you can't just download mail and delete it off the server and be compliant with Freedom of Information Act. It also ignores the fact that I can guarantee you, if the IRS is auditing you and you delete data, they will send the drives out of your servers, out of your machines, to what is known as a forensic data recovery lab, where they actually disassemble hard drives and read the data byte by byte off of drives and reassemble the data. Oh, yes, that technology exists. And I've seen it done. I've seen customers spend tens of thousands of dollars to get data back that could not be retained or recovered any other way because they did something stupid and didn't have a proper backup. It happens. It's sad every time it does. But I think, again, government tends to over-engineer things. So let's assume that it was over-engineered because typically they are. Well, the only other option then is that the data has been intentionally destroyed. And that's a possibility as well. Because forensically, you should be able to recover that data in a forensic data recovery lab. So, and again, if you were a private company or an individual with a computer and you tried to scrub all the data off, you know darn well the IRS would be sending that stuff off to get it recovered. I guarantee you they would. And they do it at your charge. The only other option is, again, that they destroyed it. And there are tools to do that because, again, being in data and storage, I've been told to do that as well. And there are tools that are free that you can download to destroy data. They use what used to be a Department of Defense standard, and they overwrite the drive with random garbage 7 times. It's a 7-pass garbage overwrite with a final pass of zeros, which just basically blanks the whole thing out and makes it so that it's practically impossible. Because even if they overwrote the drive once or twice or even 3 times, a lot of times they can get the data back in these forensic data labs. It's actually pretty darn amazing because every time you write, it leaves a ghost image, blah, blah, blah. It's physics. It's interesting, but not important. The point is that they can get that data back. Someone destroyed it on purpose. One or the other. That's the point. One or the other. It's either criminal negligence or a criminal cover-up. And in either case, heads should roll. Period. Someone should go to jail for this. It is either criminal negligence or a criminal cover-up. And I hope that there will be a full investigation as to which route or which one that is. I can't believe it's negligence. I just can't believe it. I have to believe somebody's trying to cover their butt because – and I honestly believe – well, you know what? I'm going to save this till after the break because I want to bring Dave on, get his thoughts – and let him comment, and also yours. If you'd like to call in after the break, 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the MyView Matters Radio Network, and we'll be back here in just a few minutes.
First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Try to forget. my brain when I sift through the bullshit. I can feel the strain as I grab another train. I ain't looking for grace. I'm starting to sink into countless days.
Mute. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters at AOL.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And if you're listening to us on podcast, we certainly appreciate that. But we also like when you listen live and call in and give your thoughts on the things we're talking about. And if you think we're missing some big liberty issue, we'd like to hear about that too. You can call in at 858-683-1326. We are here every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time. So if you catch us on the podcast, hope you'll join us live in the future. For the moment, though, I want to go ahead and bring co-host Dave in. I want to get his thoughts on what we discussed already. I know Dave is a technical guy as well. So, Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a bunch of BS going on. The story doesn't add up. You clarified that pretty well, but it doesn't even take somebody in data recovery, to understand that, something's real super fishy, going on here. If you've ever worked at a Best Buy, if you've done more than browse the internet and send an email on a computer in your life, you understand that there's something real fishy going on here. The story's got big implications. It goes up really high up the totem pole. The question isn't whether or not something's going on, it's what's going on and who's behind it. And it's scary because it's got to be coordinated effort of several people. There's no way that one person could do this. And it has to be a coordinated effort of several people, all of whom have very much weight, to throw around to be able to get to this kind of stuff. You know, not just anybody can go, you know, messing with what amounts to a government database.
Yes, it is a government database. And on top of that, even government employees, I mean, you're going to have some sort of directive to tell someone, delete this data. I mean, that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, the implications are even bigger. Bigger than the story itself is, you know, what's going to happen as a result. You know, if it's okay for, you know, the IRS to say, oops, whoops, you know, sorry, we had a crash and, you know, we lost 2 years, you know, worth of investigative data that's, you know, pretty serious, you know, here. We just lost it. Sorry, that's all. If that's cool, is the IRS going to stop asking people to provide receipts when they file their tax returns?
Right. I mean, that's exactly my point. It's again, a scenario of not only do we have laws that require government agencies to be transparent, the Freedom of Information Act, but we also have the scenario where if this is allowed to set and, you know, oh, well, darn, golly gee, guess that data's gone and nothing's done about it, you're again creating a double standard where government actually has an easier standard. It's a system built to protect government at the expense of everyone else, rather than applying at least the same standards that government is applying to all these private companies.
I think that's what worries me about this whole story more than anything else, is just why? You know, what is this all about? Who's being protected here? Somebody's
yeah.
definitely being protected here, and it's more than one somebody that's being protected here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we're looking at here is, you know, and actually, Ken, you know what, I know about it, but you're probably better versed, you know, in the background on this. Why don't you get people up to date on who Lois Lerner is and what these emails are?
Hmm. All right, so. Well, teach me to eat in the middle of the show. Sorry, I haven't had dinner yet, folks. So Lois Lerner is the former head of the IRS. And essentially this whole situation came out of the Tea Party movement, when the Tea Party started filing for 501c status. And quite honestly, I'm not a big fan of tea parties or any political organization having a 501c status. However, they were basically modeling what they were doing after a number of groups that had done the same thing. One of the big ones being Organizing for America, which was a very overtly Democrat machine for Obama in his 2008 election. So the tea parties basically set off down the same path. They went down and were trying to get 501c status for their organizations. And the IRS, what we do know so far, is that the IRS red flagged these things. I know from a handful of folks that were directly involved in the Tea Party movement, the types of questions that they were requiring these groups to try to answer, and they were kind of ridiculous. We need a list of everyone who's ever spoken at your event. We need a list of everyone who's attended your event. We need a list of how much money you've spent on everything for the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, things that, because they weren't previously under any sort of regulation, because they weren't a 501, they didn't have records of, right? I mean, why would you have records of things if you aren't required to keep them? And these Tea Party groups especially were very loose-knit things. I mean, it's not like unlike what some have reported, the Tea Party is very, very loose-knit. And even within Kentucky, the Tea Parties can vary very drastically as far as their focus and what they're doing. And so I guess the point is that Lois Lerner was the person in charge of the IRS at the time that all this was going on. There was a big flap about the different standards being applied to the Tea Party, as were the liberal groups. And,
this is a Cincinnati office.
Right, all out of Covington, right here in northern Kentucky. And they tried to blame it on the local office, and then it came out that, no, that was a directive that came the national IRS office. And so that is when Lois Lerner resigned, and that's, you know, when all that came out. And so they're trying to track down. The purpose of this whole committee and the hearings and everything is trying to track down who was the one that said, hey, apply an extra amount of scrutiny to these specific groups, because we do know that it was specific group names that were targeted. If you had Tea Party or Tea or Patriot or 912, which was one of Glenn Beck's things, in the name.
Or Libertarian.
There were a couple of others that those were the main three, and then there were a couple of others that got thrown in along the way. That extra scrutiny was supposed to be applied to these people, and they were the ones getting these really obnoxious, 20-something questionnaires. They wanted a list of all the people who are fans of your page on Facebook. I mean, it was just obnoxious. All the things, we want a list of everything you've ever posted to Facebook. What? And so what they're trying to determine is who came up with this and who gave the directives of this hearing. So to conceal source of these emails and the emails themselves is devastating to this investigation, because that's the whole point. We're trying to find out who did this, and if you take away the emails, then we'll just never know. We'll let Lois Lerner fall on the sword. She's all at fault. Oh well, move along. Nothing to see here. And it's my opinion, the reason Dave, I'll tell you honestly, I think that this came from both the left and the right. I think this came from the political establishment. I think it came from the left and the right, and I think that's why you're seeing not as much. I mean, there's very little news about this. I mean, considering the gravity of this whole event, the Google searching and whatnot, it's not like it's the front. This should be front page news everywhere. IRS is idiots and loses information should be, front page news everywhere. It is a big deal. And I really believe that the reason they're not getting further in this investigation is that they're getting stonewalled by the political establishment on both the left and the right.
Yep. No, I totally agree with that. And just to catch people up that may not know, the reason that these emails are so important isn't just to figure out, where the initial directive came from, and to, kind of follow it all the way back to where it originated. But as this whole, ordeal went on, there were emails that were happening between government agencies. Obviously, we're talking about the IRS, but for those that don't know, we're talking about emails that went back and forth between the IRS and no, this is not a conspiracy nut theory thing, going on here. That's really for real. That's why this blew up, because there was an FBI investigation launched, and it really wasn't part of their jurisdiction to be doing what they were doing. That's how we found out about it in the first place.
Dave,
so
I see
it's
we've
between
got
the IRS and the FBI,
too,
and also the DOJ.
Yeah. And Dave,
that's
I see we've got
a
caller
deal.
In the queue. It is a big deal. We've got a caller in the queue, and we've only got 8 minutes left. Let's bring him on real quick, if you wouldn't mind bringing him in, since I can't.
Hello, caller. You're
caller, you're on with us.
Yeah. Ken, this is Don, and I'm just wondering, this whole thing with the IRS, I'm sure has happened in several other regimes, and hasn't it kind of been like everybody's been doing it for a long while, and therefore it's not going to become uncovered because it's just a whole can of worms that everybody, R&Ds, have been involved with?
It's quite possible. I mean, that's the thing that we as citizens have to keep pushing. And, we do have some good people in the U.S. House that are willing to keep pushing. I've already contacted Thomas Massie about this and encouraged him to continue to push this, because this thing stinks. It stinks really bad. And he agreed, and I believe, based on the very brief conversation, I believe that he was inferring that other IT professionals had already reached out to him on the same topic. I mean, this is not just me spouting off. I mean, there's lots of people in my field, and we know this is garbage, man. This is just BS. And I'm really hoping that maybe it does. Maybe that's even better, right, that we uncover a systemic, you know, abuse and use of the IRS for many, 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 many years, decades. You know, we always hear that Nixon had an enemies list and used the IRS against people, too. Maybe it really is that bad. And you know what? Quite honestly, maybe this is the best thing to happen. Maybe we finally get to the core of the truth that the IRS is more about controlling people and less about paying for stuff.
Always has been, always will be. It's just that I've heard so many scandals, people saying, well, this is going to be the one that really forces Obama out, and he's still there. And frankly, you know, as long as the Republicans have done it before, then they can't push Obama out on this particular score.
I don't think there's going to be – I hear this from my friends on the right. We got to get Obama impeached. That's why we need to take – the Republicans need to take the Senate back. Man, nobody's going to do that. We've talked about on the show a couple of times. They're not going to do that. They, first of all, from a purely political and it's kind of disgusting, but the reality is they're not going to be the ones – the Republicans don't want to go in the history books for the next 100 years as the party that impeached the first black president. Let's just be straight up and honest, right? They don't want that. Plus, on top of that, the last time they tried to impeach somebody, it didn't go so well for them politically, in part because they didn't have the will to see it through. But the reality is they do not have the votes. They will not have the guts to do it. And, you know, all this stuff is just silliness. Oh, yeah, we'll impeach Obama. Oh, sure you will. He's a lame duck, guys. He's got 2 years left. The worst thing he could do is make Biden president and see what he does in a drunken stupor. So I don't think it's that. If anything, it would be a protection of the entire thing, I think. I think it would be something where they don't want to uncover all the misdeeds of the IRS through time.
Yeah, it's just that this is the sort of thing that we should be talking about our convention at the end of the month. And people, you know, more knowledgeable than ourselves here could have a discussion on this and all. And bring your tape recorder there, and maybe you might find some people that you can, you know, interview, or maybe just a string of quotes or something like that, hopefully.
You're speaking about the Libertarian National Convention that's happening at the end of this month in Columbus, I just for our listeners' sake. I think this is going to go beyond even that, though. I think this is something that is huge, and we need to have a very broad coalition. I don't even care if you're from the left wing or from wherever. I mean, if you're part of the Occupy folks or whatever, you don't like the Tea Party. It's one thing to not like the Tea Party. It's another thing to basically be silent on what is, in my opinion, either criminal negligence or criminal cover-up. One or the other, man. It's got to be one or the other.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm just saying that this is something to ask a lot of people when we get to Columbus.
I agree. All right. Well, thank you, Don.
Sure.
And we thank you for your call. And let's see here. Dave, we've only got a few minutes left, and I wanted to get your thoughts real quick on the Cantor situation and, you know, House Speaker being – or not Speaker, but the House Majority Leader being bumped for the first time in over 100 years.
Well, you know that I am sometimes – that I'm a very optimistic person, sometimes to a fault. You know, I do have a lot of faith, you know, in the human capacity for change. You know, and progress, not, you know, meaning progress, you know, change for change's sake, but, you know, actually moving towards, you know, that higher evolution of the human spirit. And so my thought on it is, you know, hey, score one for the good guys.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that this guy, Brett, is a good dude. I don't know anything about him. I hope he's better. Anyway, or at least a step in the right direction, but I don't know. I mean, he could be worse. We don't know, but if nothing else, I think it does send a signal, and I hope that people do realize that we do have a voice, and together we can stand up and say we don't want any more, and we can stop giving into the fear of lesser of two evils and all that silliness and just do the right thing, and that it can, despite all odds, have a positive result.
I want to comment real quick. We've got somebody in the chat room. I'm not sure if he wants to be named exactly, so I'll just refer to him as John. He's saying to keep in mind that the Constitution grants Congress the powers to collect taxes. The IRS is a department created by and for the Congress. It isn't an executive office function. Congress has the ability to change the IRS at will. What I'm going to reply here to you, John, is that Lerner pleaded the fifth in the case being brought against her by the Congress, and she was held in contempt of Congress for doing that. But she yet remained silent, and now with the sudden mysterious loss of the database of emails, it makes you wonder who's covering up what and why. You're talking about, Congress, and I think it's all fine and dandy that they held her in contempt of Congress. That's fine and dandy, but, if they're actually doing anything with it, then, we're going to see them do something more than hold her in contempt for pleading the fifth. We're going to see them, do something, and we're going to see them find this data. As much faith as I do have in the human spirit, I don't think we're going to see that happen.
Well, I certainly hope we do. I mean, the technology is there to recover this data.
Agreed.
We
I just
need
don't think
to,
it's going to be Congress that's going to do it.
Well, they're the only ones, unfortunately, who can, because nobody else is going to be authorized to dork around with those hard drives. And we need to keep pressure on our Congress people. That's going to be the next piece of this, is keep the pressure on to find the truth. We should not be afraid of the truth. That, I think, is the key thing. With information, with real information, we can make real decisions, and it's the only way we can keep government accountable. And a large, unwieldy agency like the IRS needs to be accountable in some way, shape, or form to, what we've got going on. So, folks, we are out of time, and I want to thank you all for tuning in. Don, thank you for calling. John, thank you for your comment. Folks, again, if you want to tune in live, we are here at 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Sunday, and also the other shows on the network, Monday through Thursday at the same time, 7 o'clock. I encourage you to tune in to keep in touch with what your government's doing. And certainly, if you've got a topic you think we should be covering, please bring it forward. We love to talk about liberty on the show and talk about what's affecting you. So until next week, folks, thank you. Thank you, co-host Dave, for especially running the show for me tonight with my technological handicap. And, folks, you have a good week. That's the show.
See you, everybody.